talking history. This is News Talk.
We shall fight on the beaches, we shall fight in the hills, we shall never surrender.
And out of that silence came thousands of voices.
The strategy of the white man has always been divide and conquer.
As one small step for man, one giant leap for mankind.
Auch die Rollen, Argus, Akhoisa.
Good evening and Happy New Year. We're talking history on News Talk 106 to 108 with me, Patrick Gagan. In tonight's show, we're looking at the life and legacy of the king of rock and roll, Elvis Presley, and we'll debate how he changed the world of popular music forever. You can email us your thoughts and views, talkinghistory@newstalk.com, and we'd love to hear from you. 90 years ago, on the 8th of January 1935, in a small two-room house in Tupelo, Mississippi, Elvis Aaron Presley was born. Over a lifetime of just 42 years, he would revolutionize music, become a global icon, and leave an enduring mark on popular culture. Elvis changed not just the sound of music, but its spirit. The story is also not without controversy, and in tonight's show we want to explore the highs and the lows of an extraordinary career. And to help me do this, I'm delighted to welcome our panel of experts. Dr. Mark Duffett is Associate Professor in Media and Cultural Studies at the University of Chester and is an expert on Elvis Presley and popular music culture, and he's the editor of the new book, Rethinking Elvis. Professor Michael T. Bertrand is Professor of History at Tennessee State University and is an expert on the American South and the modern United States, and he's the author of Race, Rock and Elvis. Professor Jack Hamilton is Professor of American Studies and Media Studies at the University of Virginia and is an expert on sound, media and popular culture, and he's the author of Just Around Midnight, Rock and Roll and the Racial Imagination. Well, you're all very welcome. And Mark, I might begin with you. And a question about the fact that this week would have been the 90th birthday of Elvis, which really just reminds us of how much he packed in to a remarkably, you know, short life. He was only 42 when he died. And it really is incredible to think how he achieved so much in the 50s, in the 60s and in the 70s, all the way up until his death in 1977.
Yeah, completely agree with you. I mean, he recorded, what, over 700 songs and did extensive touring and TV and, went global, didn't he, with the Aloha show. Did so much, yeah. I mean, changed the world with rock and roll, did everything.
And, you know, there were all these conspiracy theories about how Elvis hadn't died, that he was still alive. But the point is, you know, there are many 90-year-olds going strong. There are many people older than 90. You know, if his life had been different, he could still be around today.
Yeah, I guess he could have been. But it's very hard to know what he would have done because a lot of the claims, you can't really verify them. But David Briggs's pianist said he was going to do an album of just with the piano at Graceland. So maybe that was his next project. But certainly people have kept it going for decades in their careers, and it would have been lovely to think Elvis would have done, but of course that wasn't to be.
Michael, Elvis became a one-named celebrity. We know him, we remember him as Elvis, and his celebrity seemed to transcend his music. He did all of these movies, he did the TV appearances, there was the albums, but he became really a global icon, a global superstar.
Yeah, he did, but for me, I think what's really significant about Elvis is that how, to me, Elvis was always the consumer. He was the ultimate consumer. And I think throughout his life, he indicated characteristics of consumption. And I think what people relate to is that same sort of consumerism with him. And I think he's fascinating in the sense how in many of the barriers in the South that he came across, basically, he sort of transcended those barriers through his consumerism, loving African-American music, loving the radio. I think the radio programming is really significant during that period. But he consumed everything. And I just think that really is something that helps relate with fans throughout different eras.
And Michael, how controversial was his music, the way he was influenced by the music that he was hearing around him growing up, the fact that there were these African-American strains, the dancing, the gestures, the movements? It was something that appealed to a younger audience but horrified and offended the older generations.
Yeah, I think in the South, I think it really was a problem for him just because the music had always been there and people had listened to it before. But I think what made Elvis really different is that how he overtly really dug the music and everything about it and the style, the clothing, everything that he really got into. I think it was really in many ways, I think what it did was sort of in an and almost in a very unintentional way, I think it challenged the Jane and Jim Crow rules of the South. And I think that's what made him so controversial in that he was just having a good time. But in doing so, he was basically showing that structure, that racial structure, was very problematic, particularly for younger people who were tuning in into black radio programming, and they were getting a different message about African-American culture that had been around for generations. And I think that basically that they just in the habits of these kids like Elvis, and there were other kids like Elvis as well, they just really challenged that status quo. And I think it was very problematic for segregationists during this period.
Because Jack, he really is challenging the racial boundaries and even perceptions about rock and roll music itself, and the idea that whether it was a white person genre or whether it was a black genre, and the kind of almost the different roles that people were ascribing to different races.
Yeah, absolutely. I mean, one of the interesting things about Elvis is, and this gets back to, you know, for some things that we've talked about earlier and what Michael was just talking about, is, you know, Elvis is really, really young when he first becomes a big star. His earliest recordings are when he's I think 19. And he comes along at a period when rock and roll is really new and like no one really knows what it is. You know, rock and roll as a term is sort of like in the mid 1950s is being applied to lots and lots of different things. It's basically just sort of a signifier for music that teenagers are listening to. And so he goes a long way towards sort of like defining what that term means in a sort of popular imagination. Like Elvis really is, you know, at the first wave of early rock and roll stars. I mean, there's certainly, you know, Chuck Berry and Little Richard had national hits before him, but he's not much further after that. So yeah, definitely. I mean, he certainly, yeah, goes a long way towards really kind of establishing that early, that sort of first generation of rock and roll stars, what it means in the public imagination. And it, you know, especially just the level of fame that he hits very, very quickly. You know, he makes his first recordings for Sun, you know, a small independent label in Memphis in 1954. But by the end of 1955, he signed to RCA and Heartbreak Hotel hits. And like, you know, basically by 1956, he's just like huge. So yeah, I mean, it's his significance in terms of the history of the genre and history of ideas about the genre is, you know, hard to overstate.
And Mark, why do you think he does become so successful so quickly in the 1950s? Is it his look, his style? Is it the music? Is it the swagger that he brings to it? Is it a kind of a combination of all these factors combined with that, you know, incredible charisma? Why does he become such a major star in the 1950s?
Elvis had the entire package, didn't he? He had the looks, he had the voice, he had the moves. He had everything. But also, when you think of it, you know, he did plenty of touring. He did Louisiana Hayride. He came up as a regional star before he hit TV. And so he'd kind of honed his craft by the point that he got onto things like the Milton Berle Show and the Ed Sullivan Show. And, you know, he gave America a kind of different style of performance that it wasn't used to, because some of those prior rock and roll stars, you know, they were emerging and they were having hits on radio, but nobody had quite seen a person like this.
Michael, then we look at the second phase of his career. He was drafted into the US Army in 1958. He served 2 years. He was stationed in West Germany. And in a way, that break led to, a re-evaluation or a changing of his trajectory. You had other bands and other musicians kind of almost taking his place. And then after he returned, he had a focus more on films for the next stage of his career.
Yeah, I think Elvis, when he was talking early in his career, he really wanted to be an actor. He's sort of his goal. And I think the path that he and his management and everyone else thought would be best was to sort of go in the same way as a Bing Crosby, Frank Sinatra type of musical role. I don't think that he really wanted to do that. I think he wanted to be a serious actor. But I do think that the model had been set for that. I don't think that, you know, rock and roll, as Jack said, was extremely different. It was new. But I think some of the people in charge of the industry were still going by the old models of trying to put him into the musical settings. And I think in many ways, again, I think with maybe Colonel Parker and everything else, I think the whole point was to be successful on the long term. Elvis would have to sort of conform to that older model. And in many ways, he sort of left behind, at least publicly, some of his older influences, the African-American music and everything else. But I do think it was always there for him. It was just in terms of how he was supposed to succeed, how they thought he should succeed, was going with that earlier model of the motion pictures.
And Michael, tell me about Colonel Tom Parker, because he's one of these figures who looms so large in the mythology around Elvis. He's either this, you know, manipulative Svengali, or he's the person who's promoting him, or he's self-promoting. He is a major figure in the story.
Yeah, I think he is. I think he's extremely important. And I think for Elvis, he was important in that he actually, in Elvis's mind and maybe many others, he helped Elvis break down some of the doors to get into the establishment. I don't know that Colonel Parker really had an understanding of the music, and I don't think he thought that was his role anyway. I think his role was basically making Elvis financially successful, and he himself financially successful. And I think he's gotten a lot of criticism because he didn't seem to have an understanding of the music where Elvis came from. But Parker had been in Nashville for quite a while with the country music establishment, and so he was just basically, I think, trying to get Elvis a long-term success. And the way he thought that was, again, was to follow that model of the older entertainers. Unfortunately, that was not what rock and roll was really supposed to be about. But I do think that Elvis always felt obligated to Parker in the sense that Elvis had come from Tupelo, had come from basically very poor economic circumstances, and I think he really felt Parker had helped him get out of that, and I think he always felt somewhat obligated to Parker, and he felt this loyalty to him that many people today think was misplaced, but nevertheless, I think for Elvis, without Parker, he probably thinks he may have been back in Tupelo, which he didn't really want to be back in those economic circumstances.
Jack, how are the movies viewed now? I remember watching a load of them as a kid, enjoying them. There was always the songs and the comedy and the drama and so on. But he was making so many of them a year and churning them out. It kind of seems to have damaged his reputation and his popularity at the time and made him something of a joke.
Yeah, I mean, I think something that like has to be kept in mind with like thinking about this period of Elvis's career is that like, you know, at the height of Elvis's success in the sort of mid to late 1950s, most people kind of assume that rock and roll music is a passing fad. You know, it's something that like, oh, like teenagers are going to move on from this in a few years. So yeah, as Michael was talking about, like, there is a way that him moving into motion pictures is seen as the safe move, right? Like, it's insulating you from like, oh, there's no way people, you know, young people are going to keep listening to this music. They're going to find something else. Obviously, that ends up being a drastic miscalculation. But, you know, no one can foresee in 1958, 59, 6, you know, no one can foresee like the Beatles and everything that's going to happen in Motown and, you know, in the early, you know, it's going to sort of absolutely affirm rock and roll as like not really going anywhere. But yeah, I mean, the movies are not great, I guess is the way I would answer that. Like, I mean, I think Jailhouse Rock is probably the best of the Elvis movies. I haven't seen all of them. And Jailhouse Rock is like, it's, you know, it's not a masterpiece by any stretch. But yeah, I mean, it's, you know, so I think that for a long time, Elvis's move into movies, kind of tarnished his reputation, especially with like a young generation of rock critics who, and, you know, rock criticism as a form really starts like solidifying in the mid to late 1960s, by which point, yeah, Elvis's move to Hollywood is being seen as a sellout move, as being this sort of like, you know, he had so much potential, he had so much talent, and instead he like, you know, wastes it by going and making these sort of like disposable movies. Like, this is the narrative that starts to emerge around Elvis. Which is, you know, I think kind of unfair. I mean, a lot of, you know, with Elvis's, a lot of the controversies around Elvis do boil down to kind of people retroactively, placing these standards on him or sort of retrofitting him into more contemporary arguments about rock and roll music and what it means and what it sort of signifies culturally. But yeah, you know, there's a lot of things in Elvis's career that I think if he had known what would happen in the future, or if Colonel Parker had known what would happen in the future, they may have done differently. But obviously, you know, there's no taking those back. But yeah, I mean, the movies are what they are. it certainly was. And some of them were pretty successful commercially. But it did definitely take away the focus from, you know, Elvis's recording career to a certain degree. I mean, I think most people would agree that the recordings that Elvis makes in the 50s are, you know, a lot more consequential and just sort of musically significant than a lot of the work that he does, especially in the early, in the first part of the 1960s. He has a comeback in the late 60s, which maybe we'll talk about. But yeah, that's what I would say.
And so in 1968, at just the age of 33, Elvis Presley finds himself struggling with his career, feeling that he had lost himself and struggling to find a way back. And he did that with the most, or one of the most remarkable comebacks in musical history. And we'll take a quick break now. When we come back, we'll find all about the comeback of Elvis Presley. Welcome back. We're talking history, and tonight we are talking about the life and music of Elvis Presley. My panel of experts, Dr. Mark Duffett, Associate Professor in Media and Cultural Studies at the University of Chester and the editor of Rethinking Elvis, Professor Michael T. Bertrand, Professor of History at Tennessee State University and the author of Race, Rock and Elvis, and Professor Jack Hamilton, Professor of American and Media Studies at the University of Virginia and the author of Just Around Midnight, Rock and Roll and the Racial Imagination. Mark, how did Elvis stage this remarkable comeback in 1968?
Well, I think the way that Elvis staged it was maybe out of necessity rather than choice, in a sense, because the thing with the movies, although the movies had kind of served their purpose to some extent by this point in terms of kind of getting Elvis's name and face out around the world beyond these kind of recordings, and you know, the critical response to them was not always great, but the by this point, by the kind of late 60s, there's two things going on, really. The box office for Elvis's movies is going down because they've been kind of overproduced. I mean, he's, you know, creating maybe three a year at certain points, and, you know, this is too many for the audience to handle. The audience is also growing up. I mean, the original fans from the 50s are getting older and having children. And, you know, I'm not saying that the movies are bad. They continued in circulation. A lot of the fans that I've met became fans because they saw the movies as children. So they kind of served a purpose. But at the same time, because of the issues with the box office, what it meant was that Elvis's kind of customary $1 million fee was not available to him. So they had to create a package where they could do a film and a TV special and charge, I think it was $1.25 million to do that package. So that created the space for the NBC comeback special. And then Steve Biner was brought on board to do the direction. And he'd had a kind of controversial career in kind of cross-racial terms, doing the Petula Clark special and the TAMI show, Tammy show, which was a kind of Motown type show. And so his interest was in portraying Elvis in a way that both demonstrated the a kind of summary, in a kind of stylized summary of his career, and also kind of put him into the sort of kind of classic genres that he was known for. So, and demonstrated his kind of dynamism on stage, which is where you got the kind of boxing ring segments of the show. And I mean, this is incredible, this kind of Elvis at his best. And I think symbolically, in a sense, though, you know, we see it as a comeback, as you mentioned, Elvis is quite young at this point. And actually, you know, in a sense, this is sort of growing up for him, kind of assuming his role in a way after the wilderness years of the movies.
Yeah, it does seem crazy to be talking about someone needing a comeback at 33. You know, that's when a lot of people are really only getting going in their career, and he's having to stage this. And Jack, he seemed to have been able to use television, you know, brilliantly over the next 5 years. I'm thinking of the Aloha from Hawaii in 1973 that was broadcast to a global audience, the way he knew how to come up with these remarkable outfits and the costumes that became as iconic as Elvis himself and part of that image that the world came to have of him, that he really was able to use TV to his advantage.
Yeah, certainly. And I mean, obviously that goes back to his, you know, initial breakthrough. Yeah, he was certainly very, very, I mean, you know, he was media friendly, I guess you would say. Particularly in terms of television appearances, really, really good-looking guy, and like, you know, obviously an incredibly electrifying and charismatic performer. And certainly, you know, the comeback special is hugely significant. And is watched by lots and lots of people. Same with the, you know, Aloha from Hawaii, as you mentioned. I think one of the things that's interesting about Elvis in that period is that it is sort of, there's something a little bit, I don't want to say sad, but like, you know, the fact that he's in his early to mid 30s at this point and is already doing this sort of comeback stuff and is also, you know, like is essentially, you know, by the 70s, by the early 70s is basically sort of a tribute act to his former self. So he's also kind of pioneering the way that like a rock and roll musician will age, except he's doing it at like a younger age than we would associate. You know, you think about a band like the Rolling Stones that's been performing now for, you know, I don't know, 60 plus years, and are very much at this point, you know, you go see the Rolling Stones and they mostly just play music that they made in the 60s and 70s. But they're really old, like they're in their 80s. Elvis is certainly making some great recordings in the late 1960s. Suspicious Minds and that era is in that period. But yeah, in the 70s, it starts to, he is really more in a different phase. I mean, he is still making original recordings and even having some hits, but there is a, yeah, it's a different shape that his career is taking in that period.
Michael, how should we view his private life? He met Priscilla when he was stationed in Germany. She was 14. He married her 7 years later. They married, they had a child, and then it ended in divorce in the 1970s. And he never, I think, seemed to really recover from that. I think that marriage breakup had a huge impact on him.
Yeah, I think with Elvis, I remember talking to Sam Phillips years ago, and Sam Phillips said that Elvis really, looking at Elvis as a kid, as a teenager and going forward, he was in it for the girls in many ways. And I'm not saying that lightly. I'm not saying that, you know, making fun. I'm just saying that he was really into in the adulation that he was able to meet a lot of women. And so I think it's interesting in the sense that with Priscilla, that eventually he settles down with her and does that. But if I could get back to the television for a minute, Patrick, I really think it's important to remember that Elvis, when he back in the 50s, and I think Jack and both Mark make this reference, he really seemed so comfortable in front of the cameras. When you take this kid basically from Tupelo in Memphis at 21 years old and going on the Dorsey Brothers show and then Milton Berle and Steve Allen and so forth and Ed Sullivan, if you look at him and watch him on the stage, you just see this, he's very comfortable, and it's almost, it's always tongue-in-cheek with him. He's always sort of laughing and he's having a good time and he's really enjoying himself. And going back to the 68 special, I think one of the things that Steve Bender really understood after talking with Elvis, in that going back and doing some of these sessions where he just allowed Elvis and some of his older friends and bandmates to sort of just jam and basically look, you know, play music that they had been listening to. And well, that was the way Elvis approached music, I think, from the very beginning. Elvis was very much a radio guy. He'd listen to everything on the radio and then he just kind of performed that in the recording studio. What was so significant about that 68 special is that the way Bender sets it up, in many ways, some of the more successful parts of that program would be where it was sort of an informal jam session where he's allowing Elvis just to do what Elvis had always done as a performer, and that was basically just enjoying himself performing the music that had always been so important to him. And so I think they captured that really well in that special. And again, he just had an unusual, and it would really seem for a kid coming, a working class kid coming from Mississippi, he had a very unusual relationship with that camera, and that he just was very comfortable in front of the camera and also in front of crowds as well. But it's amazing to me to watch him from some of these 50s appearances on these shows that he was not overawed at all. He just basically was extremely comfortable doing that and reaching out to people through that camera. Again, going back to the charisma we've talked about this evening, it's fascinating to me. And I think it's a true genius of Elvis Presley in the sense of how comfortable he was in front of that camera.
Michael, what was it like talking to Sam Phillips? Because Sam Phillips was the founder of Sun Records, produced some of those early recordings by Elvis, as well as recordings of Roy Orbison and Johnny Cash and so on. Did he recognize the genius and the greatness and the potential of Elvis from the very start, or was he as surprised as everyone else?
That's interesting. I think when by the time in later in his life, whenever I encountered Sam Phillips, I think the script had been written pretty much, that people who knew Elvis had basically gotten used to certain themes in Elvis's career, and I think Sam was part of that as well. But no, I think when Elvis, I think one of the people who really is sort of always kind of hidden away is Marion Kiesker. When Elvis first walked into the Memphis recording studio, I think it was Marion Kiesker that basically recognized there was something in Elvis that she had heard Sam talking about. And I think she often is overlooked. No, I think Sam understood, after Elvis started appearing in person and also in the studio as well, that Elvis had what he thought was extremely an unusual catalog of music and choices that he could perform and perform from everything, as people have said on this panel as well, that, you know, the blues, rhythm and blues, country music, pop music. And I think Phillips recognized that. I think he recognized that there was something that Elvis had that he was looking for, but also something that was very unusual.
So, Mark, what went wrong then in those final years? He had made the comeback. He was reaching a global audience. He was producing music again. And then it just seemed to unravel. There was the drug use, the heavy eating of fast food. He seemed to age dramatically. He became bloated. It seems to be an unhappy spiral and decline in those final 4 years of his life.
Yeah, I guess Elvis was up and down at various points in the 70s in his final years, and there was a decline at those times. As for its cause, I mean, it's very hard to psychologize a person, but I think one thing's for sure, you know, we were talking about women there, and Elvis was clearly very, very close to his mother, and the loss of his mother towards the end of the 50s was kind of inaugurated a kind of 20-year experiment in what to do. And you can see Elvis exploring, if you like. But then, you know, the knock of his divorce, his career kind of, you know, when would you say the high point of his career was? You know, was it the comeback special? Was it the Aloha concert? Certainly by those latter years, you know, he was touring a lot. And also, in a sense, the touring had saturated the market. So he was touring smaller and smaller places. And I've got a ticket in my collection from Hollywood in Florida. So he was sort of touring these interstitial markets as well as going back to some of the big ones. I don't think that his career was as rewarding as it was before. And I think certain mental health challenges set in, you know, connected with the prescription drug use as well. And, when you're in that situation, it's very hard to reach a person. And I think that was Elvis's issue. But I think it was variable. I don't think Elvis was like that all the time. But I think certainly, you know, in the last year and even at various times before that, yeah, his weight fluctuated and his drug use fluctuated.
And Jack, he died then in August 1977 at his Graceland estate and only 42 years old. And how was he viewed at the time of his death, and how did his legacy and his reputation change in the years ahead? Were there periods where he became more popular or less popular? Was he rediscovered at different times in the years ahead? For example, when Baz Luhrmann made the biopic of his life, or has he always been in the popular consciousness in those decades since?
Yeah, I mean, I think he's really always been in the popular consciousness. I mean, I do think that, yeah, I mean, like any icon of that magnitude, you know, his sort of what he means to various generations has changed and things like that. I mean, it's interesting, like, he, you know, as you mentioned, he dies in 1977, and 1977 is itself this kind of mythic year in music history. It's often, you know, seen as the year that, like, punk rock breaks through. You know, there's just a lot. It's generally one of those mythologized landmark years, like 1968 or something. And yeah, there's a way that, like, you know, Elvis's death, and, you know, you think about, like, the sort of what's happening in punk rock in the U.S. and the U.K. Like, it's, there's a nostalgic element to it of, like, taking rock and roll back to its roots, its sort of simplicity, and it's, like, those original energies. And Elvis is really, like, you know, important in that imagining of it. So I think there's a way that his, you know, death in 1977, like, prompts a lot of nostalgia for that early period. Like, there's a very, very famous obituary / appreciation that Lester Bangs, the famous rock critic, writes in 1977 for, I think, The Village Voice, called "Where Were You When Elvis Died?" That's very, very nostalgic and sort of looking back on that earlier era. But yeah, I mean, you know, he's certainly someone that, like, just, yeah, continues to mean a lot to, I mean, certainly, like, Elvis's, you know, fan base is just incredibly powerful. Like, if anyone's ever been to Graceland, which I highly recommend to anyone, if you're ever in Memphis, even if you're not an Elvis fan, it's just a fascinating place to go. And you'll see just, like, these incredibly devoted legions of fans who are there. And yeah, certainly, you know, the Baz Luhrmann movie is from, like, you know, 2 years ago or something, and makes, you know, ungodly amounts of money, showing that there's still, you know, an appetite for, you know, the Elvis story among people who, you know, are now getting into, like, sort of Gen Z. so, yeah, I mean, he's certainly endured. I mean, he's not going anywhere. But he is, yeah, like, just this, like, you know, it's almost like the icon of Elvis has, like, inevitably overshadows, like, the sort of reality of the human.
And Michael, it is extraordinary as well, the fact that even people who might not think they're fans of Elvis, or they might not think they love Elvis, we all know the songs. You can go through the greatest hits, and, you know, I'm looking here at Spotify, at some of the albums and the singles, but we know so many of the songs from Hound Dog, Jailhouse Rock, Blue Suede Shoes, All Shook Up, Heartbreaker. Like, you put them on and people will know them, people will recognize them. Over Christmas, we heard all of the Christmas songs and Lonely This Christmas and so on, that they're kind of are the backing tracks or the soundtrack of so much that we experience in our daily lives, on the radio, when we're going out, when we're watching popular culture TV or film or so on, that Elvis is there in the background and sometimes at the very front.
Yeah, no, I think, you know, you get movies come out today, television shows, commercials, and, you know, Elvis's music is there. I do think he's a marker in our culture. He's someone that is recognized. I think he is someone that is, you know, for what he achieved. But I think he has that iconic status that people remember. And talking about the 70s, when he died, at that particular time, we think about nostalgia with Grease on Broadway, and then Grease the movie and everything else. I think there was, you know, again, people have sort of cyclical in looking back every 10 years or so at different things that were going on. But I think with Elvis, I think he's somewhat timeless.
Okay, well, we're going to take another quick break now. We'll play you out with some of Elvis's great magic. This is Jailhouse Rock.
Purple gang, let's rock. Everybody, let's rock. Everybody, sweet, never let me go. You have made my life complete, and I love you so. Love me tender, love me true, all my dreams fulfill. For my darling, I love you, and I always will. Love me tender, love me long, take me to your heart. For it's there that I belong, and will never part.
Welcome back, we're talking history. There's Love Me Tender, the classic 1956 ballad from Elvis Presley. I'm rejoined by my panel of experts, Dr. Mark Duffett of the University of Chester and the editor of the new book Rethinking Elvis, Professor Michael T. Bertrand of Tennessee State University and the author of Race, Rock and Elvis, Professor Jack Hamilton of the University of Virginia and the author of Just Around Midnight, Rock and Roll and the Racial Imagination. Jack, when we talk about the legacy of Elvis then, how is he remembered? How should he be remembered?
Oh man, that's a. I think he's remembered a lot of different ways by a lot of different people, and like you know, probably a lot of that has to depends on how sort of old one is. Yeah, I mean, it's sort of you know, Elvis is such a massively famous and again, like not to keep using this word, but like mythologized figure that I think for a lot of people, like they sort of encounter this idea of Elvis before they really know that much about him. I mean, like, just I find with my college students, and this is like, you know, changed a little bit since the movie, but the Baz Luhrmann movie, but you know, a lot of them instantly know who Elvis Presley is, but actually aren't familiar with his music, or at least like aren't aware that they're familiar with his music. So he's sort of someone who's like, his fame is at such a high level that I don't want to say he's at this point like famous for being famous, but there is this sort of way that, you know, he's this one word, one name, icon. But yeah, I mean, his reputation has changed and evolved a lot over the years. I mean, he's certainly a very controversial figure. You know, he's over the years been sort of a lot of the controversies over rock and roll and sort of issues of race and, you know, sort of racial appropriation and, you know, commerce versus art, like all these big, big, big topics that loom over rock and roll. Like Elvis, like disproportionately comes to sort of signify these debates in a way that I think is sort of unfair to him as an individual. But yeah, so he's, you know, someone who, is just there's a lot on him, in terms of his legacy. But yeah, I mean, I think he remains, you know, far and away, I think the most famous figure from that early sort of first generation of rock and roll. I mean, he's like really, I don't know that I would say he's the first rock star, because there were certainly, you know, Chuck Berry and Little Richard had hits before him, but he achieves a level of fame that's just astonishing. And you know, as Michael noted too, like there is this way that Elvis is this kind of quintessential rags to riches story in American popular culture. You know, he kind of comes from this very, very humble working class background and then becomes just like unfathomably successful by, you know, a pretty young age, and is able to live his life, the rest of his life, in this like incredible opulence at Graceland and in Las Vegas and things like that. Like, you know, in this way of like, oh, he had all this talent and he sort of like made it work for himself. So there's that aspect too.
Michael, what about that question of cultural or racial appropriation? The fact that here we have a white musician becoming famous, becoming rich, taking these influences and sounds and from African American culture. He has been criticized for it, but I wonder, has Jack something there that it is unfair when it's in fact him showing his love for these different types of traditions and different culture, rather than the people who are disrespecting it and alienating it and trying to stop it.
Yeah, no, I think that's, in terms of Elvis being remembered, I think a lot of people, that's is what they tend to remember, is the issue with the racial appropriation. I do think it's complicated. You know, and I think the models that we have, even in the scholarly field, is in many ways, we don't really recognize someone who is basically a consumer of the music and all types of music and loves the music, and then becomes an entertainer that becomes extremely successful with that particular music. I think it's difficult really sometimes to make that distinction, but I think obviously the recording industry and the music industry itself were very willing to back in the 1950s when rhythm and blues was taking off. I think they were very, and again, as Jack said earlier, they didn't see this as anything permanent. They saw this as a fad, but they did want to get in on the fad. And so they were looking for someone that could actually perform this music, you know, and they tried to find Pat Boone, things like that. But I think it's important that what's different, again, is that Elvis was not part of that establishment in the sense of the industry himself. He was basically someone who loved the music. And I know it's difficult, you know, it is difficult to recognize that Elvis became fabulously wealthy and famous for performing, largely performing a music that was created by someone else, by another group of people. But at the same time, it's really, I think, important to remember about Elvis that this kid loved everything. He loved all sorts of music, and he really dug rhythm and blues. One of the things that's really fascinating with that, if you look at pictures, when Elvis in 1956, Elvis was waiting to go to the WDIA, the radio station in Memphis, that African American oriented music that was playing since the late 1940s. They had a benefit show that they did every year. And one of the things that Elvis, as a fan, and again, we always forget about Elvis really before Elvis, and this goes way beyond after he becomes Elvis, but he was a fan. And he was looking so forward to this WDIA program. And he went over, and we see pictures where he's actually, they've taken pictures, and I guess Ernest Withers, the famous African-American photographer, took photographs of Elvis with these different stars, and one of those with B.B. King. And one of these pictures, and, you know, we see the picture of Elvis, and it's like he is so excited just to be in the presence of B.B. King. And it's like, you know, this is like a kid going to the candy store and all of a sudden being able, you know. And so it's really important, I think, in this appropriation business, which, again, is a very significant topic, and it's a very important one. But I think we need to look at it from the perspective of a kid who just loves music, and he tuned into everything. He listened to the radio all the time. And so, again, to basically understand that he would go into the recording studio, and what he would, and not being a songwriter himself, what he would do is he'd basically record things that he had heard on the radio or records that he had bought. And so I do think that we need to make that distinction with Elvis and think about that with the appropriation.
Mark, is part of the problem that he was a singer who became an icon, and the weight of that responsibility was a heavy burden for him throughout his career?
Well, certainly Elvis was an icon while he was alive. And I think we have to remember, you know, by, 1973, he was kind of clearly a global person in that respect. Although, you know, arguably you could say that about 1956. And then equally, you know, his iconic status was proved because he was actually living on Elvis Presley Boulevard for the last few years of his life. So I think he knew he was an icon, but clearly. I think in terms of Elvis and these kind of discussions about appropriation and things, we have to understand the kinds of things that Michael was talking about there. And I think Elvis's iconicism turns him into a placeholder that allows people to have these kind of discussions
And they're not just discussions about race and music, although those are included. They've also been discussions about kind of high and low culture and taste, which was a major kind of topic when Elvis died, because the Albert Goldman biography came out and the Elvis What Happened book had come out slightly earlier than that. And there was a kind of question about whether Elvis should be kind of part of the cultural furniture of America or not. And that upset a lot of middle class people and artists and people like that. And so there was a sort of a moment there in the early 80s where Elvis's reputation was kind of, up for grabs in a sense. And really what's happened is that Elvis's estate and other people, people like Peter Kralnick with his biographies, have kind of worked to create a kind of middle brow and a reclamation of Elvis, if you like. But clearly, I mean, Elvis, in terms of the appropriation question, I think I follow Brian Ward's book, Just My Soul Responding, I think is very good on this, because he talks about the way in which during the civil rights era, kind of both like the younger black audience and the younger white audience, but kind of leaning into this music that was kind of in the middle. And, it wasn't just that white kids were buying Elvis covering R&B tunes because that was a safer thing to do, because, if your parents caught you with an Elvis record, that was probably less bad than being caught with like a Little Richard record or whatever. But also, there were black kids buying Elvis's music. You know, those early rock and roll hits were hitting big and being bought in the R&B record shops as well. And even occasionally, black kids were buying Pat Boone records. I know it's sort of certainly hard to believe now, all these years later. So I think the perspective we have on it now is different to the perspective that happened at the time. And I think we should take both into account when we have a full discussion of it.
Brian, I think that's an excellent note on which to end our discussion tonight. My thanks to Dr. Mark Duffett of the University of Chester, the editor of the new book Rethinking Elvis, Professor Michael T. Bertrand of Tennessee State University, the author of Race, Rock and Elvis, and Professor Jack Hamilton of the University of Virginia and the author of Just Around Midnight, Rock and Roll and the Racial Imagination. Well, that does bring us to the end of our first edition of Talking History of 2025. My thanks to my producer Marisa Sullivan and Peter Malloy on Sound. We've got more debate and discussion next week, so hope you can join us then. We've been talking history. Good night.